Hi, everybody. This is Tracy. Today, I have a very special guest with us. Her name is Amy Pohl, and she works with the Colorado Coalition Against Domestic Violence, which has just renamed themselves the Violence Free Colorado. And I'm on a survivor caucus there, and I love being a part of this bigger community. I love being part of a group that changes policy and raises awareness and both physical and emotional sexual abuse. Today we're going to talk about the financial cost of domestic violence. There's so many different ways that I bet you will be surprised when you hear what she's got to say. So let's welcome Amy and let's get started. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
I am so excited to hear our topic today, but before we start that, I would really like you to tell me about where you work, because you work for an agency that I know just changed their name. It used to be Colorado Coalition Against Domestic Violence, and now you've got a new name, but most people don't know about services that are like the company that, or the organization that you work for.
Yeah, thanks for asking. So I do work for an organization called Violence Free Colorado. And as you said, it is formerly the Colorado Coalition Against Domestic Violence. We are still the statewide coalition against domestic violence for Colorado, but we changed our name because we wanted folks to understand what we were for, not just what we were against. And so we're really hoping to change that conversation to include thinking about what it is that we're working toward as an organization, and that is truly a violence-free Colorado. So to that end, we do a lot of work on a statewide level, and most of the work is really supporting the more than 40 domestic violence advocacy organizations across the state of Colorado to provide consistent and high-quality services to the survivors of domestic violence in their communities. We also work with other allied organizations and professionals to make sure that every person in the state of Colorado that touches the life of a family that's experiencing relationship violence has the resources that they need to make sure that they're meeting the needs in the most trauma-informed way possible.
That's awesome. And you have a lot of stuff on your website that can really do that supporting. So if you have a friend or a sister, you can get the resources from your website, correct?
Exactly, yep. And we're at violencefreecolorado.org. And lots of information to help support folks who might be experiencing abuse, and also what to do when you might know someone who is using abusive behaviors in their relationships and how to have those conversations.
Nice, nice. Well, Do all states have an organization like the coalition?
They do. Most, actually all 50 states have a coalition. Some of them are what we call dual coalitions, which means that they work with people doing work in both domestic violence and sexual violence. Colorado happens to just have two separate coalitions, but we work closely with the Colorado Coalition Against Sexual Assault to make sure that where there's that overlap of folks experiencing both domestic and sexual violence, that we're getting those needs met. But yeah, all 50 states and all of the United States territories have domestic violence coalitions.
That's great. So everyone can know to look that up. I actually have a list of all of the organizations on my website by state so that they can drill down and find something and start the help process. Because when I first found out about my abuse, I went to an organization that's under you guys, Safe House for Progressive Alliance, and I got amazing counseling. It was the first validation that opened my eyes to what I had been going through. And so I encourage people all the time to reach out to these organizations and just start the ball rolling so that you can get healed.
Yeah, absolutely. And for folks out there who might not know where to start, certainly our website is a resource, but also the National Domestic Violence Hotline. They will, if you call the National Domestic Violence Hotline, they will make sure that you get connected with the resources in the area that you want to be connected to. So perhaps you're in, you know, Nebraska and you're wanting to leave the state because you don't feel safe. They can help you find resources in a state where you might be going. Or they might be able to just help you find resources in your very community that you're in that you might not know about. So that's a great resource too.
Yeah, I always have the domestic violence hotline in my comments. So I really encourage everyone to reach out to them. And again, if you don't want to look up the information, call that hotline. They're going to have what you need to get started on your recovery.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So today our topic is something that I saw at a domestic violence symposium, and you were on stage, and I loved this topic so much, I thought, I've got to get her on my show. So it's the hidden $1 billion cost and the economic impact of relationship abuse on survivors, families, and community. So today we're going to talk about what is financial abuse, because it starts with that, and then we'll go down and drip down to some of the other ways that it costs everybody. So can you tell us about financial abuse?
Sure. So we know that a financial abuse occurs in almost all cases of domestic violence. And so it's an incredibly pervasive tactic of control that people who use abusive behaviors use to trap their victims in those relationships. And in fact, we know that it's often cited as one of the main reasons that victims stay in abusive relationships is because of that financial abuse. The number one reason victims stay is for safety reasons, actually. And financial abuse and economic abuse are often cited as the second reason that victims stay in a relationship that is abusive, or that they return to an abusive partner because of that financial abuse. And simply, financial abuse is just tactics that an abuser uses to conceal information, limit a victim's access to assets, or reduce accessibility to family finances in a way that's used to gain power and maintain control over that victim in a relationship.
Yeah, and like simple examples are not letting you have, if you're on an allowance and you can't save any of your own money to make an exit plan.
Right.
You can't provide for your children if it's very structured and they control everything.
Right. Yeah. Right. And, you know, as with other kinds of abuse, financial abuse can often begin pretty subtly and then it progresses over time. So, you know, at the beginning of a relationship, it might look like something as simple as, a partner saying, you know, I know you're under a lot of stress right now. Why don't you let me take care of the finances and I'll give you money each week to take care of what you need. So it seems like a way that that person is actually supporting their partner. And the victim may in fact believe that they can trust their partner. And so give over that control. And maybe the victim takes on other responsibilities in the relationship, like childcare. And so it seems like something that seems really natural to a relationship, but unfortunately, then that progresses over time to where a perpetrator might have all of that control and not be willing then to relinquish that control of the finances. And sometimes it means that when the victim does want to take back control, they can't, or that person, their partner has moved accounts or no longer is going to give that person access to accounts. So again, it can start really subtly and then progress over time.
Yeah. I mean, nobody goes into a relationship thinking, there's this love bombing stage. And when you're setting up a household with a partner, like you take this, you do the laundry, I'll watch the kids, you take them to school, I'll pick them up. It becomes you're splitting responsibilities. But in that same regard, that you're also losing any control if it gets worse. I mean, it's fine in a perfect normal situation where you can still log into the bank and see what you've got and see what you're spending it on. But if you have absolutely no control and someone's telling you you can't buy the kids like snow pants, that's when the control goes off the other edge and never giving you access to the financial documents that you need, or as you said, even moving money. A lot of people have that happen where, you know, they had a retirement account and the abuser has dipped into it, and suddenly they are unaware that there is no savings.
Right, right. Yeah, and so certainly that not allowing the victim to access bank accounts, withholding that money, running up large amounts of debt on joint accounts or on accounts in the victim's name, and therefore ruining that person's credit. Mm-hmm. So that if they want to have some financial independence after they leave that relationship, that's harder to do. And then it kind of grows from there. It can also be forbidding the victim to work or to attend job training or further their education so that they can make more money if they were to work outside of the home. It might be sabotaging work or employment opportunities by harassing that person at the workplace. Sometimes it's even that an abuser will refuse to work and contribute to the family income. And then we also see it sort of travel into that trafficking realm of maybe forcing the victim to work in a family business without pay. So not being able to be compensated fairly for what that person is doing, and therefore then not being able to have access to any kind of financial stability if they want to leave that relationship.
Yeah. For my own experience, I had a great job when I met my second husband, and you know, you don't have to work. You don't have to work. Well, that took me out of the workplace for 10 years. And then when I got back into it, I wasn't valued at where I was before.
Right. Right. Yeah. That's huge.
Yeah.
And so we see that even after someone leaves an abusive relationship and feels safe enough to do that, that those, as you just mentioned, the impact continues on. So for instance, in your case, that being not as employable as maybe you had been if you had stayed in the workforce, mm-hmm. but also it might be direct impact, like an abuser refusing to pay child support or being underemployed so that they have to pay less child support after a divorce or custody proceeding. So then again, putting that victim in a really precarious financial situation.
Yeah, well, as we're on this, the legal abuse system is also a financial drain.
Yes.
And I know that I just sent, I don't know if you read it, but I sent it over to our group the other day. There was a new law passed in Tennessee that stopped frivolous lawsuits from abusers to victims, because that's another way that they abuse you, is constantly taking you back to court, making false claims and running up divorce bills, running up custody fights. And that's a financial drain that very often the victim can't, if they've been limited to the money that they have access to, how are they going to fight for their children?
Right.
If all the money's been gone and the legal system starts to kick in.
Right, exactly. So as a former attorney, I represented victims of domestic violence in custody and divorce proceedings, and we saw that all the time. And in fact, we know that in anywhere between 25 to 50% of disputed custody cases, there is a history of domestic violence.
Wow. That's interesting. So, yeah, the whole legal system and the things that can happen. Again, it goes back to control, right?
Right.
It's all about control. And even if they don't want the children, they're going to fight for them because you do.
Right.
So it becomes.
And it makes it really difficult then for a victim to leave, because if there's a chance that you might lose your children to the abuser, because you can't afford to keep up with the court costs, that's a pretty good reason to stay in an abusive relationship, is to make sure that you are around your children and that you can try to better secure their safety. So it sets up a system that keeps that victim having to return to the abuser for a lot of different reasons.
Yeah. Now, I know that domestic violence has a cost to the workplace, and that there is things that happen between productivity and other things at the workplace. Do you want to give us a little overview of that?
Sure. Yeah, it's really, I think, if you consider the fact that we know about 1 in 4 women will be a victim of domestic violence in her lifetime, and probably 1 in 10 men will, and you imagine that how many of them are actually employed, this is an issue that impacts the workplace every day. And employers have a real vested interest in addressing domestic violence in the workplace, and here's why. First of all, it really can endanger employee health and safety. So we know that about 75% of domestic violence victims face harassment from their partners while they're at work. And that's a huge chunk of the working population. They also might experience anxiety and depression. And of course, that impacts their health and the safety of themselves at work and others. It also really can undercut productivity. So a lot of survivors have to miss days of work because of the act of physical abuse and the repercussions from that, or because of court dates. You mentioned before that prolonged litigation and is a tactic of abuse, and of course that means more missed work days if they're having to leave for court cases, and of course increased healthcare costs across the board. And because we know that employers are the primary providers of health insurance in this country, when health insurance rates go up, employers are directly impacted. So there's a lot of reasons of why domestic violence impacts the workplace and directly impacts employers. And what's important to note is it's not just the victims that whose workplaces suffer. There was a study that was done on over 500 people who used abusive behaviors. And what that study found was that about a third of them were in contact with their partner or ex-partner to engage in behaviors that were emotionally abusive or to monitor their partner's actions while they were at work. So abusers are actually abusing while they're on the job. And they've actually caused or almost caused work accidents as a result of being distracted or preoccupied with that behavior. So it's not just the victims, employers, and colleagues who are impacted. It's also the perpetrators, employers, and colleagues who are impacted by that behavior.
Right. And just having someone that is emotionally distraught over any type of abusive situation, whether it is physical or emotional or financial or legal, they're at work and they're a mess.
Yes.
So, you know, the productivity, as you said, but it brings everyone else down. People are walking on eggshells because they don't want to ask them for that paper that was due 2 days ago because, well, they were in court. So it brings down teams and it brings down like the entire company, and it costs them money. It costs them money in every regard, from the productivity to the insurance costs. And so what kind of costs are there to employers?
Well, you know, for healthcare services, just to treat victims of domestic violence in the United States alone annually costs more than $4.1 billion. So, you know, that's both short and long-term healthcare costs. So short-term healthcare costs might be costs related directly to some sort of physical injury from physical abuse. But we also know that medical care costs include some of that long-term care that might be mental health care for folks who have experienced abuse. That might be care of injuries that are more long-term. So domestic violence is actually shown to be a major source of traumatic brain injury. So injuries that result from potentially being struck on the head, or even from strangulation, which happens in a number of physically violent relationships, lead to traumatic brain injury. And so the cost of healthcare over time for those sort of long-term injuries, again, feeds into that number. So I think that about $2,000 more is spent each year for victims of domestic violence than just general female enrollees in healthcare plans. So that might be from the use of emergency room services, that might be from the use of, as I said, short-term care options, but also long-term physical and emotional care options.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really helpful. So how can companies, what should they be doing to help employees when they've been through this? Or, you know, what kind of services should we be looking for our employers to have at their disposal?
Sure. You know, it needs to start from the very day that people walk into their place of employment. And here's how that looks. So first of all, adopting a workplace policy that directly addresses domestic violence, that should be at the top of the list for all employers to do. And then they have to communicate that policy to employees as they come on and onboard into that company, so that right away that employee knows that this is a place of safety, and that if they have a problem, that there are people that they can go to at work to try to get resources to better achieve safety. And so that also includes domestic violence, including domestic violence information in the workplace. So maybe that's information up in a bathroom stall, or again, through the employee handbook, different places that you could provide that information. They can choose health plans that include domestic violence services, including health and mental health care. So again, letting people know from the very beginning of employment that these are the kinds of values that we have in place, and we're here to support you. They can also educate employees and managers on what domestic violence is, how to identify when someone might be experiencing or perpetrating domestic violence, and then what are some of those assistances and referrals that they can give to those employees. And then that all helps to create a culture in that workplace that says that domestic violence is not okay, that we're not going to tolerate it within that workplace. And of course, that also includes an intolerance toward all gender-based violence, including sexual harassment. So again, it's sort of wide-reaching, but once you start really making that a value of your place of employment, it really easily feeds into all of those different places.
Yeah. And I would think, I know that I've done a bunch of videos on, I say narcissists, but at work, because they're not only abusive at home, they can be breaking up teams if they're at work and they've got this, you know, kind of control thing going on. They can bring down a team by having someone that they're attacking or doing things at work. And I think employees need to know that it's okay to talk to someone in HR and giving them the permission to say, you know what, I know he's my boss, but this is the kind of behaviors I'm feeling and seeing, and could you look at this without being judged, without being living in fear that you're going to be fired because you just said something bad about the boss.
Right.
It happens in the workplace every single day, and yet and employees that might be the victims of someone, a coworker, a boss, they're intimidated to ever speak up.
Right. Yeah, I mean, abusers typically take advantage of their positions of power to use those kinds of behaviors. And so it's really hard when you're not in a position of power to, or authority, to think that you have a place to speak up, as you said. And so again, creating that culture can help other employees feel comfortable coming forward and saying, you know, this is happening and it's not right and it's not okay. And it's affecting all of us. And while I think employers have an ethical obligation to address that, frankly, if they need more motivation, that it does impact the bottom line. So they have a financial motivation too, to make sure that those kinds of behaviors are addressed.
Right. And just keeping, you know, a safe workplace. Mm-hmm. You know, we're so heavily into the Me Too movement now. And I know victims that have been sexually harassed at work mm-hmm. are just so afraid to speak up because their livelihood, their family's money depends on them staying there. So they are forced to kind of keep their mouth shut and not speak up. But I'm so grateful that the Me Too movement is out there and sort of empowering people to stand up and say, whether it's at home or at work, this isn't right. And, right. you know, for the employer to feel like we're here for you.
Right.
And that's such a big piece of this. So.
Absolutely. Yeah. And if there are employers out there that are saying, yes, we're seeing this and we do want to adopt this, these policies at work, but we're just not really sure where to start. There are resources out there for workplaces. So futureswithoutviolence.org is a great place to start. They have a whole workplace safety and equity program. And then also workplacesrespond.org has a great resource library for employers. So there are resources out there. And I think that you're right that especially because of the Me Too movement recently, there's a lot of employers out there who are really motivated to change their policies and adopt policies that make sure people understand that their workplace is safe and equitable.
Yeah, I will put all the links down below that you just mentioned so that people can just click right on them and bring them to their HR department and say, hey, look, maybe this will help you.
Yes.
Because it just takes one person to stand up if it's just to talk to HR and say, you know, here's a good resource because HR people aren't necessarily, perusing an abusive channel
right.
or going there. They have to deal with it in the moment and they don't have the knowledge of where to go. So that right. little tidbit that you just shared with us is going to help a lot of people out there.
Good.
And is there anything else that you want to say to tell the people that may be experiencing this, how important it is to get help?
Yes. I think that the one thing that I would like to say more than anything is that you're not alone and that there are resources out there to help you. And I want folks that maybe know someone out there who's experiencing abuse to understand that those people are the experts on their own lives. And they are, if they stay in an abusive relationship, there are often really good reasons. And as we've mentioned here today, financial abuse is at the top of those lists of reasons. And so people are going to feel like they can leave a relationship that's abusive at their own pace. And so it's really our job out there as the community to provide those resources to make sure that when victims out there want to get help and feel like they're in a place where they can access resources, that they're out there. And so again, I just want victims to know that you're not alone, that it's not your fault, that we believe you, and that when you're ready, there are resources out there available and we're happy to connect you with those.
Yeah, and start with that domestic violence hotline and just see what help is near you and start the ball rolling. Don't be afraid to pick up that phone. It's not a commitment that your abuser is going to necessarily know about. It's something that you start to plan. And when you're leaving an abusive situation, don't do it alone. Know that there is help and that you don't have to know all the things you need to do. But if you just take one step in that direction, you might go down a little bit, but you're going to get up and you're going to start to empower yourself and help your family, because the family dynamic and the children that are there are looking for you to be strong. And it just takes one step. So,
yeah. And there are plenty of resources across Colorado, especially, but again, across the entire nation and worldwide.
Yeah. So thank you so much for joining me. I really appreciate all that you do and sharing this with my audience today.
Well, it was certainly a pleasure, Tracy. And thank you so much for inviting Violence Free Colorado to join you.
You're welcome, honey. Talk to you soon.
Okay.
Thank you for joining me today. Please subscribe to my channel if you haven't yet. I'm doing an expert series and we are going to keep bringing you experts that you need to know about that you need to know that these services are out there and that there is help and we're going to find it for you. If you haven't visited my website, narcissistabusesupport.com, but one of the takeaways that I'd like you to take away is to write down this phone number. I'll put it down below, but it is the hotline.org website, and it is the 800 number, 800-799-7233. If you call that hotline number, no matter where you are in the United States, they will lead you to organizations within your community, within your state, within your area that can get you help, get you started with some counseling. They have financial support. They have housing. There's all kinds of agencies out there that can help you no matter where you are in this recovery process. So call that number, 800-799-7233, and let's get you some help. That's all I got. Have a great day.